With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, this is Douglas Piccinini from Savannah, Georgia. And you're listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, well, being creative often leads one to do mundane jobs. But what's the worst job you've ever had? Okay, here comes the show. And remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dane Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, a.k.a. The Hizzer.
Hello!
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from...
Everything from Douglas from Georgia, USA's question, what's the worst job you've ever had? Dane, what's the worst job you've ever had?
That is easy. My worst job was working as an agency executive at the Trader Media Group, working on Auto Trader.
Very specific.
Absolutely specific. That's the first time I became aware of how anti-Semitic English people were by working in that office. Plus, the racism I wasn't too surprised by. It's where I probably heard for the umpteenth time someone say, you might be smart and I went to university, but I'm still your boss. I overheard someone saying their job will never be in danger because they went on a stag do with the commercial director. I watched two people have nervous breakdowns because of the workload. I spent most of my time doing a disciplinary. My manager threw me under the bus, only to reveal that I actually wasn't falling short of my target when his job was up for redundancy, which he had kept to himself.
Wow. So that definitely sounds like the worst job. Definitely.
The worst job with the worst people. So much so, but that being said, it was so bad, it's the reason why I am a comedian today. Because I was like, there is no way I could have done a job like that long term.
Worth it. And mine was definitely being a double glazing salesman on the phone for a month. I nearly wanted to stab myself in the face. We ask and answer all the questions.
No question is too big or too stupid to ask, guys. And if you like asking questions and hearing answers, and more importantly, if you like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify where you'll never miss an episode. Or you can follow us by subscribing to our podcast on Acast, the world's largest podcast network.
Oh, yeah.
All the special people, all the special questions. And on today's show, we have a writer, actor, and the only Filipino comedian working in the UK today. She won Best Comedy Show at the Greater Manchester Fringe and was a finalist in the Amusements Comedy Awards at the Edinburgh Fringe. She can be seen on Amazon Prime and BBC iPlayer for BBC World Service. She has written and presented her own Channel 4 documentary that revealed the truth behind the myths that surround Oriental women in Britain. She also has a degree in virology. So, a woman who I would very much endeavour to emulate. It is the very real and the very talented Ria Lina.
Hello. You make me sound so good. I'm impressed with myself. Did I really do all that?
You did. Yep. You did in such a short space of time, as well as being a mother and a wife at the same time as well. Normal womanhood juggling all the balls without having any balls of your own, Ria. And we welcome you.
Well, you know, I have a husband, so I have at least two balls.
Are they still intact? Are they still intact, Rhea, or not?
Well, that's my prerogative, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, Howard. Depends how she feels on the day.
Rhea, what's the worst job you've ever done?
That's a very good question. Because I'll be honest, I hated all of them until I got to comedy. Like, none of them were quite right. Do you know what? It wasn't so much which job did I hate the most as who hated me the most in the jobs that I did. I think that's the true answer as to how I ended up in comedy is who hated... I think the worst... I was a civil servant for 3 years in a particular department. I don't even know if I can mention it. Well, I think it's out there. I worked for the Serious Fraud Office. Doing IT forensics. And I love forensics, and I always have, and I love computers, you know, who can live without them? But I really, really struggled with the hierarchy. And it was exactly like Dane said, people above you that left school at 16 and were your boss and you came in with a degree and they go, I don't care what you can do with programming. You will cut and paste because I told you so, because that's what I'm comfortable with you doing.
Wow.
So that kind of thing.
And that's the workplace in general, is people that didn't get any further than post 16 that try and recreate that same paradigm of friendship that they had when they were in high school. And yeah, the place of business, the service industry, is not meritocratic. So how can we be surprised we're in a fucking recession? So because you got a bunch of fucking idiots in charge. And then everyone was like, it can't be that bad. And then we let this foolish nepotism spread to our government. And that's why we are where we are today. A bunch of cut and paste motherfuckers, Ria.
I totally agree. I think that really anybody who wants the job should not have it in government. The moment someone says, I want to be prime minister, you go, and that's why you never will be.
Yeah, absolutely. I find it very, very worrying to have a bunch of people that speak about, you know, having the political ideology that they want to be an independent republic and be free of like heavy taxation. But they're like, I want you to pay my salary as a taxpayer.
Stinks a bit. I mean, I just think it's all over, isn't it, really? Like, I just think these old ideas of politicians and even just independent countries, right? Like, I just think, God, as if you're going to solve your issues with not being part of some great big union, arguably of Europe, but, you know, it could just be international. I just don't think it's going to work, is it, really?
I mean, I've said for a very long time that the multinational is the new corporation, and anybody who still thinks that their borders are intact or they have a distinct place has probably never taken a walk down their high street lately. If you have a McDonald's or a Starbucks or an Apple in your country, then your country is no different to any other country, and you should learn to shut the fuck up.
It's a strange one, isn't it? Because we're talking about respecting other people's cultures, you know, and not culturally appropriating, but at the same time, we're getting rid of borders and trying to intermingle and create new identities. So I don't know what I can wear anymore.
I think it's a good time to have a question, Dane, before we just go into a place of death and hell.
Absolutely. Howard, first of all, we tread on the line of tragedy as comics. That's what we do.
It's just the episode went in quick.
Yeah, but
went in quick.
But did you see how deftly Rhea played along the line of the rise in like international tensions and then was able to cut through that tension by bringing it back to what can you wear, which is pretty much how most people even identify cultural appropriation. So that's just giving our listeners an insight into how good this episode is going to be. Rhea, thank you so much for being on the podcast. As our very esteemed guest, we invite you to ask the first question, which we will discuss for 50 minutes or some change. Then Howard will ask a question and we'll do the same. And then lather, rinse, repeat. I'll ask the final question. And then we all go back to picking out what wardrobe will be the least offensive this weekend. Sound like a plan?
It sounds like a great plan.
Absolutely. Well, as our esteemed virology expert and comedian and artist, we invite you to ask the first question.
Well, thank you. My first question, and I guess me being a scientist explains why I'm asking this question. My question is, why do people need religion?
Give us a bit more context of your thought process about that, Rhea.
So I've been thinking, so as you know, we're in the middle of this pandemic and we're still divided. Even we came together for about a month as a UK nation and we clapped the NHS and we all stayed indoors and we followed the rules. But now we've fallen back along similar bipartisan lines, and we've got people that are following the science and we've got people who firmly believe that Hillary Clinton is a pedophile and that masks will kill you. And as someone who looks for the evidence, as someone who's constantly reading, and as someone who's going, okay, I know how much we don't know about this virus, so I understand why we're being cautious. I'm seeing people believing in these causes, in the anti-masking, the anti-vaxxing, you know, all of conspiracy theories, yeah, the QAnon stuff. I'm seeing, and I think it's akin to religion. I think that in the absence, we are the most secular that we've ever been. Well, in the last 2,000 years, which is the most secular society we've lived in, and people are believing and holding on to these things without further examination. They've kind of read one thing, one book, and gone, that is my Bible, that's what I believe, and I will fall on this sword. And it says that essentially even without religion, people find their own religion. And I'm wondering why there's that need in people to do that. Why can't we be comfortable with not knowing everything? Why can't we be comfortable with just being cautious right now?
I mean, I definitely can give you a quick answer, and then Dane will probably elaborate, give a big elaboration, which is death. death. We are all fearful of dying, Ria. Most of us, anyway, just don't like the idea of dying. And I think religion was used as a way of kind of dealing with your own mortality. And in the absence of kind of, you know, basically probably a lot of people doubting the existence of a heaven or an afterlife, or a God, you know, I think we are finding people just drawn to other things that offer a way of kind of, like you say, some kind of devout belief system that they can get behind, even if it's complete bollocks.
Yeah, I get that. But right now, a lot of the things they're believing don't lead to death, do they? I mean, the pedophile ring, Pizzagate, that doesn't lead to death. Bill Gates microchipping everybody, that doesn't lead to death.
It's just a distraction, though. That's kind of what I mean. It's a distract. All of this is a distraction from the fact you're going to die.
Well, that being said, a lot of people do actually believe, yeah, that they are going to die. But it's a really good question. I just want to check before I give an answer, Ria. Scientifically speaking, what are you defining as religion?
Oh, good question. Good question. I think it's the need to believe or the need to have faith in something.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see it as being.
Cool.
Because there's the need to be in a religion, which we've seen for thousands of years. And we know that, you know, Native Americans had their, you know, there's been spirituality all the way throughout human history. And it's usually been very connected to nature. And then it became a means of controlling the population. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way. I mean, there's a reason now that Judaism and Islam don't eat pork, because there was a point where eating pork would kill you.
Exactly.
And so the leaders at the time said, don't eat the pigs. And they're quite cute.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly the point is for me, is that it's, I think why religion still plays a part is that I think, as you said, we are quite secular. And I think what maybe has now supplanted religion is identity politics. I feel like there's a quasi-religious aspect to identity politics in that people are able to rationalize their own existence, whether that is their own aspirations or lack of fulfillment, by attaching themselves to an ideology or an idea that seems to be a lot more prosperous, which they can, you know, identify with. So where people may not be religious zealots in the West, for example, what you find that people are like sports fanatics, and they're able to attach themselves to this idea that this team is progress, by proxy, I'm a part of this progress as well. My support provides me with the return on investment that this team will become prosperous and I can share in their victory. So I'd say the first part of the answer to the question is a large part of why people need religion is rationalization. I feel like it allows people to deal with a lot of aspects of life which in themselves cause a certain level of duality or a kind of paradox in most human life. Like, for example, as Howard was saying, people are very afraid of death, but you would think that if we are all aware of our own mentality, that would have a lot more of a bearing on how we live our lives. Like, if you know you're going to die at like 80 years old, would you spend 40 of those years at a desk in an office? I'd say most rational people would be like, no, that'd be a waste of fucking time. But then once they start working, becoming a part of the workforce and conforming to being within the proletariat, then they stop thinking about it as much. And so religion or any other, I guess, external idea of a higher power that someone can attach to allows for them to rationalize their situation. So, for example, I would consider white supremacy to be a religion in that it's a faith system that a group of people use to identify with other people, makes them feel empowered, but most of all has no factual or scientific basis for its belief system. And so people believe in white supremacy because if you are a cisgender, heterosexual white man, the odds of you becoming a millionaire or a billionaire, like most people, is going to be nominal. That's just the way the world of capitalism works. Now, if you are aware that you may not be able to achieve that much in life and you may not be able to realize your financial aspirations or your professional aspirations, then one of the ways you are able to rationalize this is to know that wherever you go in the world, you are going to be considered to be superior to that entire population. They're going to speak your language. And your culture, despite the fact that you are a minority, even in that particular nation, will still be a dominant culture. And for some people, they can attach themselves to that idea because it means no matter who I am or how little I achieve, I can attach myself to an idea that I'm better than most people on the planet just by the merit of my birth, despite me not doing anything, which to me is nigh on, you know, religious fanaticism.
Oh, my gosh, I'm a religious fanatic because I totally believe that wherever I go.
Yeah.
Ria, do you think... Have you ever been religious about stuff particularly, or have you got anything that you've ever kind of followed to a religious kind of level?
Well, I suppose anyone in the other camp would listen to this and argue that science is my religion, because I suppose that that's what I cling to. But I see that the two camps, as I divide it, is I'm interested in evidence-based, I'm interested in what I can feel, what I can touch, what I can tangibly see has been proven or not proven. And everything else, therefore, is an unknown. But you accept that as an unknown, and you accept that how little you know. And I suppose the other side of it is I have faith in what I don't know. I have faith in everything that I don't know. And I'm there going, I don't need to have faith in it. I just accept that I don't know it. So I think that's the two sides of it. No, I've never had religion in my life. My parents, my mother particularly, is staunchly atheist. So I think that in pushing back against that, I didn't push back to become religious, but I pushed back to become a patheist, which is little known as a belief system, but when I was looking for the word, I was looking for what I was, and I found it, and it is called a patheism. And so you have atheism, which is the staunch belief that there is no God. Then you've got agnosticism, which is you're not sure if there's a God. And then you have a patheism, which is I don't give a crap if there's a God. it doesn't make a difference to my life. There could be, if you want there to be a God and there is a God and I get judged after death, fine, that's when that will happen. But I'm not going to change the way I'm living now, and I'm not going to change the way I make decisions now based on that. I'm going to base it on what I have in front of me. That doesn't mean that I'm like running around killing people, because everyone has an inbuilt moral compass. Like, you know, do not kill, do not steal. That's all kind of inbuilt in most of us.
Well, that's a good point as well, because again, like you said, there is an esoteric idea amongst us human beings as a social species, or we should understand, as well as mammals, that there is an interdependence between ourselves and other human beings and other sentient beings as well. So like you said, intrinsically you know that I shouldn't cause harm or loss to another sentient being, and I shouldn't take anything or kill anybody. Now again, going back to the topic of religion, like that is a esoteric truth that we all have, but religion, again, people adhere to it because it allows them to negate these ideas. Because you can be like, well, you shouldn't kill another human being, you shouldn't take from another human being, but then if you have a institution or quasi-religious institution which tells you, but they don't act like humans, they don't believe in our God, then people can give themselves justification for that. An example being apartheid, which was justified A, by Hermetic principle, which is a religious idea that comes from the book of Exodus, and also the fact that indigenous Africans within South Africa during apartheid were referred to as non-believers. So in that particular instance, there was the politicization of religion in order to dehumanize the indigenous population and justify them being oppressed. So that's where religion comes in. So patheism is the first time I've heard of it. And it actually, I like that idea, because it's like, you know, whether there's a God or, and you know, and actually, Rhea, I think it's a really valid point, because I always try to say to people, the issue with religion and how it's administered and how people apply it to their lives is that people look at religion almost as if it's very rigid. And that's probably where science has the issue with it, because science is supposed to be dynamic, and you're supposed to be able to retest theories and change a hypothesis or have a null hypothesis. And that's what religion, considering the topics that it's discussing, like, you know, the idea of omniscience and omnipotence, they should be, more than anybody else, happy for science to investigate the existence of a God, because you should be comfortable that there's definitely going to be a God. You shouldn't think or believe, you should know. And this is normally where the schism with science and religion appears. But it's like,
well, it becomes impossible to delineate, right? Because and it's also that history, isn't it, really, Rhea? Because history, centuries and centuries ago, their basis for science was just so limited that it was easy to say that there is a God, and, you know, you can live this way. Whereas now we have such, you know, I would say advanced levels of scientific analysis that you just can't, you know, it's like, it's pretty obvious. Like if you know, science is there in your face half the time. It's like, I broke my leg. Well, I didn't just go to my mate Dane to fix it, did I? I'm sure you could do a good job, Dane, but you know.
What, Howard, you didn't just believe it would fix itself?
Well, this is it. Exactly that. You're not I've got a kidney problem. Can someone just kind of pray for me, please? Well, fuck off. Like, that's ridiculous. But that is mental.
But that being said, though, Rhea, like, is there scientific study that proves, like, you know, if people use methods of repetition or affirmations, can that have an effect on them physically? in terms of like, you know, is positive energy or is hypnosis
recognized?
Of course,
it's called the placebo effect.
Yeah. So if someone takes that and is able to repackage that as a religious phenomenon, is like it's been able to subvert science for, you know, the process of like, you know, dividing or controlling people. So I think religion still exists because prior to some of the existence of our more secular, bipartisan political systems, it was one of the most effective methods of population control and social engineering. I say that example for us. I read that Charles Darwin himself was actually a member of the clergy before he espoused this theory of evolution.
Wow.
While I see evidence for evolution as scientific theory and not on scientific facts, I think where the theory is flawed is when it takes on a religious narrative, in that we speak about survival of the fittest and dominant species.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, one of the reasons being is most of the time this is epitomized in a picture of us going from primate to Homo erectus to Homo sapien, Neanderthal. By the end of that evolutionary chain, you have a European-looking white guy with a spear. I've never seen a fucking white guy with a spear in any book of archaeology or anthropology. So, as you've seen there, that's been racially politicized to show as if the first example of a Homo sapien is a white man. But by the definition of species, scientifically, that is about an organism which can mate with another organism and produce viable offspring. That means the only members of our species, Homo sapien, that could have been the first Homo sapien, would have to be a woman, because as mammals and as a species, women are the ones with wombs that make children. So if women make children, it means why is there a man at the end of that evolutionary chain? It's because that scientific theory has been politicized and made quasi-religious for the sake of conquest in this case. Also, the fact that, like, we talk about a dominant species, that would suggest that we as human beings exist as a separate species from all other animals. But that's impossible, again, because scientifically what you have is an ecosystem and a system of synergy where we have to interact with a system of symbiosis with a number of other organisms, like, for example, the bacteria living in our gut or the microbes that are on our skin. So there can never be a dominant species, because without these bacteria in our gut, we cannot survive.
That kind of brings us back to the purpose of religion being to subdivide us amongst ourselves. As you were saying, we're still very tribal. We can't get away from the fact that it's built into our brains to be tribal. And as you said, the need to belong and the need to be able to go somewhere and to be part of something. I thought your sports metaphor was very apt to say that, you know, that's why people follow certain sports. And that's why, particularly in this country, football is so popular. That makes a lot of sense, especially if you're like a Leicester City fan. It makes a little less sense if you follow West Brom at the moment. You're not so much reveling in their wins as their losses, but, you know, there's hope. There's always hope. And I suppose that's part of it. But I think that what you're talking about with the dominant species is quite interesting, because we've broken away from our ecosystem. I think if there's one thing both truly religious people and truly scientific people can agree on, it's that we are not in harmony with our environment right now. We are very much not in harmony with our environment. And I think that if there was the one thing Howard asked me earlier, if there's one religious thing that I was probably a part of, I think the Gaia hypothesis is the one that sort of swayed me the most as I was growing up.
Explain that for the people at home who might not know.
I think Gaia hypothesis is the idea that all life is connected on Earth, which sounds really wanky when you say it that way, but it's exactly as Dane described it, that we are not alone. We are not islands. We cannot survive without, I mean, the food chain alone. Even if you're vegan, even if you are the best of the best in terms of not causing harm, you're still relying on plant life to keep you alive.
Because you're 70% water, and there's a water cycle that you depend on, and you definitely depend on plant life, because just literally to breathe. So,
yes. So I think that for me is the most religious I've ever been, is going, we are all connected and we need to not forget that.
It's such a great question. And I kind of feel like we definitely could talk about that one all day. My final two pence worth is until the full explanation is given for what happens in our brains, until we fully understand our brains, I think you can still have that question mark about, you know, us all being interconnected, religion, all of that still has, until everything's been explained by science, Rhea, we're always going to have religion, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think this is it. We're seeing it now. We're seeing that people need to believe in something. And that's what we're even seeing now with the reaction to the pandemic.
We're also seeing people tweet on their actual phones, tweeting on their phones that the Earth is flat. You're using a phone that requires a satellite to bounce transverse waves off it to tell people the Earth is flat. You're fucking stupid. Rhea is nice. I'm not nice. I'm going to be a scientific zealot and be like, if you believe the Earth is flat still, you're fucking stupid and you failed in school. And this is why you need to attach yourself to these other ideas so that you can believe that you are a part of something. But you're a part of a bunch of fucking idiots. So, Rhea, what I'm trying to say is that, like, you know, scientifically, evolution can be up to a million year process.
Up to? I don't think there's a limit, Dang.
Yeah, there's not a limit. It can take ages. The thing is, religion, however, is so archaic that people are still referencing events from 2,000 years ago as a basis to live now. So that tells you how religion has been able to prevail so much.
It was the Harry Potter of its day. The Bible was the Harry Potter of its day.
Exactly.
And as much as we can criticize the author, doesn't take away the amazingness of the book, right?
Yeah, although, yeah, I mean, exactly. A question for another day is, who still gets the royalties from the publishing of the Bible? Because someone must do.
Wow. I'm going to ask a very different question, but it will probably link up a little bit with what we've been discussing. But that was an amazing question, Rhea. Thank you for bringing that to this podcast.
We got some great answers.
But my question is, I was just going to give it a bit of context, because I suppose it applies to everyone, really. But, you know, I went to university and I did American studies. It's not very useful, really, if I'm honest with you. It didn't really mean a lot to my life. I suppose it helped me a little bit of some stuff, but it's not proving very useful. But Rhea, you studied virology, right?
Yes.
And has that come in useful at all? Because I assume right now you might be quite popular. my question is going to be this, because we've kind of, interesting that this podcast has kind of evolved over this pandemic, which me and Dane moved it up to every week. It means that we can be a little bit more topical at times because we're putting it out pretty quickly. And so, listen, let's talk COVID, because we often don't on this podcast. When, Rhea, I'm asking you, help me. When are we going to get to the end of this?
Do you know what? That is actually the big question. And it's one that I'm asking as well. What is the end point? What are we aiming for? It seems pretty clear that this new coronavirus, SARS-2, is going to be with us. It's reached around the world. It's in the population. It's going to be very tricky to get rid of it. I mean, if you know, it took a couple hundred years to get rid of smallpox, and that was with the help of an effective vaccine.
And also people not being able to vocalize their disdain for wearing masks or covering themselves up on social media networks, or with their ability to express misinformation. So,
Well, precisely. There was governmental control back then, so they were able to stamp it out by controlling the people, whereas now people have gone crazy. That is a good question. What is the end point? What are we aiming for? I don't think the scientists know. I don't think the governments know. I think the idea right now is they're aiming for a vaccine to come out and hopefully help control the severity, at least, of infections, because we don't even know how effective these vaccines will be. We don't know if they're going to last a year, if they're going to last 5 years.
On average, with a background in virology, how long does it normally take to synthesize an effective virus? Because, yeah,
Vaccine?
A vaccine or virus?
Both questions, actually. When you say it that way, Rhea, good question. How hard would it be for you to put... Because, you know, I mean, as well as the hysteria and some of the craziness, conspiracy has also become as prevalent as the infections. And, my question is, how long would it take on average? Because I spoke to a friend of mine who said that an effective vaccine for corona or for COVID wouldn't appear for, like, it would take an entire generation for that to work. And, but then at the same time, how hard is it to make a retrovirus or like a coronavirus?
You want happy news as well. This really narrows down what I can say.
No, go on, we'll have all the
news. Howard wants happy news. I want the real news.
The real news is...
Give us the real news.
It normally takes years. And it usually takes years to go through the process. Obviously, what we're seeing is people fast-tracking. And by people, I mean like the FDA in the US, PHE here, just... allowing things to happen faster than they normally would, allowing us to go through testing phases faster than maybe we otherwise would. But that said...
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra.
and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
On the one hand, I think the fastest vaccine was made in 4 years. That was the fastest that we got from virus. And that was way back in the 60s. So that's incredible. That think of what the science was back then. But on the other hand, we have yet to come up with a successful vaccine for HIV. So that's the range of possibilities that we're looking at. However, and what people forget is that when SARS-1 and MERS came out, which were two epidemics that happened in the last 20 years, people started working on vaccines towards coronaviruses. So we're not starting from brand new with the vaccine that we're working on now. We can build upon that previous technology. We can build upon that previous work that was done. Because what happened with this, like, for example, the SARS epidemic is it came out, people started working on it, and it disappeared again. And we haven't seen SARS-1 come up again since then. And so you can't test a vaccine if you don't actually have active infections in the population to test it against. And so that all got frozen in time. So when we say it took 4 years in the 60s to develop, I think it was it the measles or the mumps vaccine? I'd have to fact check that. I can't remember which one, but it was very, very quick. It was 4 years in the 60s. So it's not unbelievable to, it's not unsurprising to believe that we can do it faster now because we have also the entire world working on it. Not just, you know, with SARS, it was a localized epidemic. It never became a pandemic. So there weren't that many labs that were working on it. Whereas right now, everybody in the world has a vested interest in coming up with a solution to the current pandemic. And
well,
so
there's a massive competition going on, isn't there, between kind of a load of different research facilities.
So much of a biological arms race that between the West and China. I want to actually throw something into this area because I feel like what may be different to the 60s and now is the role in which capitalism and global capitalism and consumerism plays in global society as opposed to as it did in the 60s. I say that because I feel like one of the key issues in terms of treatment of the pandemic and in terms of whether it's finding immunity or just protocol by government in terms of like citizens and their exposure to the virus is we're dealing with two viruses, because the other virus, or three viruses, arguably, because it's the virus, well, actually, no, one virus, the other virus being racism, and the issue being the religion of capitalism.
Mm.
I say this because, obviously, referencing our previous question, is that I feel like a lot of the reactions to COVID, a lot of the policies that have come into place, in many ways, do not have a scientific basis and serve the needs of capitalism more than the needs of, you know, scientific research.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that's the thing. What we're seeing right now is science versus scientists versus economists. That is the battle. And I think that we can't ignore, and again, I say this as a scientist who is a virologist, we can't ignore the effects that the economy are going to also have on the health and the well-being of the nation. And people have been shouting about it. And I don't think that they're wrong, that we need to look at the effects of locking down on people's mental health, on domestic situations. I heard a story from someone who works in an ER about a kid who came in who was quite badly damaged by a parent, and that parent had no signs at all ever before of ever having been abusive or anything to their children, but they just snapped. And this was in July. They just snapped after, you know, being at home for 5 months, people losing their jobs, people unable to pay rent. Like there are other considerations. And so I appreciate that if you're in charge of everything, yes, you have to worry about this brand new virus that we really don't know everything about. You say it's a respiratory virus, but we're seeing effects on the liver, the kidneys, the brain, inflammation. We're seeing people walking away with months and months of issues after infection. So they've cleared the infection, but they're suffering from fatigue. They're people needing lung transplants, like all sorts of things that we just don't understand about this virus because we're not even a year into it. But what we do know, and I think this is what some people, you say the religion of capitalism, what we do know and what we can hold on to is that we do know it's having effect on mental health. We do know it's having effect on people being able to stay in their own homes because they can't afford the rent anymore, jobs. So it is a tricky balance. I agree with you that capitalism is a religion. And it's interesting that you refer to racism as a virus because it's an interesting metaphor to bring forward. I'd have to think on that one a little bit and sit with
but
that.
But can I ask one question, just because you know, it's not often I have someone who has some kind of academic expertise on the subject, even though we all have an opinion on it, right? Which is one of the weirdest things about it all.
Thanks, Twitter, for making all of our opinions matter.
opinions are like assholes, and Twitter is a sewer where everyone's assholes are filtered out.
It's so true. Just like one little bit at a time.
But kind of, and this is kind of bringing into, this is an awkward thing to bring up. I'm aware I'm about to say is not, you know, not something I believe. It's more a question about this subject. Is, you know, you're looking at the economics versus the science, and is there an argument at some point where people are going to turn around, or the majority are going to turn around and go, well, let's just let what happens happen and stop this trying to stop it, which is what obviously we've done, right? We've tried to stop it. We've tried to stop it affecting people. But do you think, Rhea, that people will just at some point go, if it kills me, it kills me?
It's funny. I have a friend on Facebook, of course. I have a friend who's also on Facebook, and he is straight, white, cis, male. And he has started saying things like, why can't we just ring fence the vulnerable and let everyone else get on with our lives? Why can't we, you know, why do the rest of us have to suffer for the few? And so people are already thinking that way. They're already thinking two-tiered thinking. We're talking about people not being allowed in shops if they can't prove they've been vaccinated, which is essentially forced vaccination on people in the future. We're talking about being able to prove if you have the antibodies so you can live freely, but those who haven't had it yet can't. And it's two-tiered society. We're talking about creating, that is very clearly creating levels of people. And we've been fighting against that for such a long time that we can't go back to that. We have to treat everyone as equal. It's a real, I'll tell you this, as an ethnic woman, I find it a real bum deal that even this virus is like, who are the safest? It's the young white people.
I would say then, Rhea, this is what I mean, is that like you, it's very hard for you to form or apply scientific theory in this instance when you have to take into account capitalism, which ideologically fuels which is a machine that is a religious machine, but the fuel for that machine is racism. So it's very hard for you to have a discussion about, like, you know, treatment of a virus when the supposition is the wealthy are going to have the instant access to this, despite the fact that they may not be genetically predisposed or biologically predisposed to deal with the virus better than any of us. Because I've not had COVID, and I've followed precautions and kept myself safe and clean, whereas the Prime Minister fucking got COVID after he went around shaking people's hands in a fucking hospital. So for me, it's like, very clearly, this is somebody who, by biological theory, or even by Darwinian theory, is someone who is not effectively able to use fight or flight to escape a dangerous stimulus. But because of the position afforded to him by his race and by his wealth, he is allowed to survive. So again, that, for me, that defines scientific theory. If we are determining who is the most vulnerable, really based on, their wealth rather than their health.
And Rhea, just because we're going to have to move on to our final question of the episode, give us some hope. Will you?
No, Howard. No. No, Howard. No, Ria. Don't listen to him. No. No, Howard. Please. Why? Why? Oh. That's the problem, is that that is not scientific. Like, you've asked a... This is the problem, is that instead of... We're asking scientific experts for their analysis or for diagnosis or prognosis, and then they tell us, and then we go, well, I don't like that. Tell me something I want to hear. No, you need to fucking hear it. Like, this is dangerous. It has, even if you survive the contraction of it, there are still long-term effects that are going to help us. So, for example, I'm saying it like this. It's fine that we turn around and clap the NHS and we are providing relief or subsidies for key workers. But then I would argue scientifically, if you are not providing a framework socially whereby your most gifted and most competent are able to be at their optimum level of productivity, because they have somewhere to live and they can eat and have access to water and can provide for themselves, a doctor or a nurse that's had a good night's sleep, had a decent meal or a square meal, and has somewhere to live, is going to be able to do their job a lot better than somebody that has to tread fucking water because of government policy. So it's all nice and well of us giving hope. I'm saying we can have hope if we need to. Because we've been weaned on capitalism for so long, we are talking about a global pandemic and we're expecting these people to find the cure because we want to get back to work and blah, 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 blah. For me, it's like, first of all, if you've got a problem with fucking lockdown, people need to take a look at other systems like the penal industrial complex, which is a capitalist funded institution where we keep human beings incarcerated when they might not be necessarily healthy psychologically. So if you've got a problem with being at home for 5 fucking months and turning on your kids, well, what do you think happens on Rikers Island every fucking day? Also, I feel like if you have a problem where you're like, oh, well, how are people supposed to go back to work and live and survive? If you allow for capitalism to continue to cause rapacity to our fucking ecosystem and our environment, it doesn't fucking matter what happens with viruses, because once you go back outside, in the next 20 years, we're going to cause irreparable damage to our environment. So it's fine if your lungs are fine from COVID, there's still not going to be oxygen to fucking breathe. So how I feel is, if we want to be scientific and have hope, then I hope that people are able to suspend their need to buy new fucking things all the fucking time and sit down and shut the fuck up. Let scientists do their fucking job. Listen to what they fucking tell you, and then you can have some hope. This is the problem is that, like, and I'm not saying it's not yourself, Howard, but it's a really...
No, of course. Taking it personally. Yeah, of course, Dave, of course. It's all right.
But it's a very interesting point, because you said give us hope. But this is the thing, as Rhea is saying, is that the issue is the remit for scientists and virologists is for them to give us accurate scientific information.
Hope, as we know it.
As we know it. Because that's all under the pretense that it's dynamic. We're always continuing to test, continuing to learn a lot more. Hope is irrational and doesn't have a scientific basis. And while we do need it, and it can be effective, those two parties in this instance can't meet. You can't be told what you want to hear. You need to be told what you need to hear.
Well, actually, I tell you what gives me hope is talking to Rhea, partly,
yeah.
And hearing someone talk science, you know, and with knowledge is a dying art. You remember when they said we're tired of listening to experts? I mean, we definitely shouldn't be. I found it very interesting to hear what you had to say, Rhea. Thank you.
Can I just say it was 5 years and mumps vaccine? That was the fastest one to date. Was a 5 years to the mumps vaccine.
Cool. And, you know, and the thing is, crazy things, people be like, that's not that bad. Well, 200,000 people have died in America, and that's in 1 year. So times that by 5, that's 1 million people. So, you know, this shit it's not easy. It is literally a precise science.
Yeah.
Well, one thing we can keep doing, which is making a podcast. So that's good.
While we can.
Yeah. Before the internet crashes in some horrible way.
Hey, something new comes along.
Dane, over to you for the final question of today's episode, which has been a very, very thoughtful episode.
It's cool. It's been very thoughtful and very, very helpful as well. Saria, the preface for this question is that you're dead.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Now, personally, I believe...
Is there an afterlife in this hypothesis?
That's basically down to you. So the question is that most of us, when we pass on, especially those of us who have dependents in the form of our children and our partners, will leave their last will and testament, where we can betroth all of our worldly possessions to those who have lost us. However, I feel like some of these things pale in comparison to what people's greatest loss is when they lose a loved one. So I say all that to say this. Rhea, regrettably, you have gone to a better place. What that place is and how we describe it, that is down to you as a scientist to describe on another day, or you can do it during the question. But if you were to have a will, and your will is not just a will that's physical, but it's a metaphysical will, where you can leave behind or betroth character traits or behavioral traits, talents, skills to the people you love. You can leave everything in your will. You can even leave like your eyes, the sound of your laugh, like that thing you do that your husband likes. You can leave it all in your will to different people.
Oh, Dane, I've been married so long, that doesn't happen anymore.
Exactly, so there you go. So you can even leave behind your current sexual impotence to somebody if you choose. But what is Ria Lina's last will and metaphysical last will and testament?
All right, I know a few of them. So I have three kids and a sister. And she's a bit like a kid. She's my little sister. And she can't commit. She is the most commitment phobic person I've ever met. She can do long-term fuck buddies. Like she can stay with a guy for 3-4 years. But the moment he goes, can I introduce you to my mother? That's it. She's out. She's like, no, I don't need to meet your mother. You've seen me naked. I can't look your mother in the eye. So I think that I would leave to my sister the ability to commit. Because I think she deserves to have some. She actually just says to me, you've had three kids. One of them has to look after me when I'm old. And that's, she's just like, can I just have one? and I'm like, that's not fair. You work in banking. I have to pick which of my kids gets it good and which of the other two have to look on and be bitter about it. That's not fair.
Although if she never gets married, then all three of them can spread that divide that inheritance too.
Well, in theory, but if she would feel obliged to give the one that looked after her a little bit more, right?
Which, it'd be your most generous child, I guess. Which one's the most generous?
Well, it's tricky. So they're all teenagers right now. So let's say none of them.
Yeah, that's true. Who can tell?
So I would leave my sister the ability to commit because I've been with my husband through thick or thin for 19 years now.
Fucking hell, that's a long. Sorry, pardon my language. That's a long time.
It is a long time.
What happened to you, Hopi Hopinson? She says 2 decades, and you're like, that's a fucking long time. Aren't you married?
I was just really impressed. It was like, fucking hell, that's good, isn't it? Like, well done. Like, fucking you, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Good work, mate.
Yeah, thanks. Neither of us are who we are when we met. Let's be honest. I would definitely leave my daughter all of my, I guess, woman knowledge. I have one daughter and two sons, and I want to leave her everything that I've learned about being a woman. And I want to leave with her the memories of growing up and the times that I grew up so she can compare them to the time that she's living in. And gosh, if I could inherit this from my mother, I would. My mother's Filipino and she grew up in America. And I realized recently that she grew up, you know, before the civil rights movement had even, you know, I think my mother had to sit at the back of the bus. Because she's quite a dark Filipino and she's never spoken about it. But I think that she probably suffered in that system. But she became a physicist and a computer programmer. We're talking 60s and 70s. We're talking at a time where that was just unheard of for a woman, let alone a woman of color. So if I could inherit that from my mother and then pass it on to my daughter, I would, especially because my daughter is blonde. Like, my mom's Filipino. I'm clearly an Asian woman. And my daughter's this white girl. And I'm watching her live the life that, you know, she's the girl I hated in high school. I'm raising my nemesis because she's there and she's, you know, and she's popular and she has her friends and she walks around with confidence and, you know, and she flicks her full luscious curly hair, and I was there with my long, short, dark, you know, my dark, straight hair. But I would give that to my daughter. I would give her all of that. I want her to carry forward all of the progress that we've made. And I know that the Me Too movement only kind of broke social media in 2017, but trust me, everyone listening, we've been working on it for a while. I can't not leave something to my boys, right? I can't not leave something to my sons. I think that I would leave the flip side of that. I want both of my boys imbued with, I want them to be good men. And I'll be honest, I don't know how to do that. No, I don't know how to raise, I don't know the magic formula to raise sons to be good men.
I've been writing a list here of the things that I'm going to pass on.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, Ria did the same thing that I've done, which is you go big, Dane. I think it's hard to go specific, almost because I don't know if you analyse yourself enough to really look at the specifics of the very, you know, minor details of who you are.
Well, this is why I wanted to ask Howard and both Howard and Ria, because existentially, that's the question is that do we take a lot of time to analyse the better parts of ourselves? Because when you think about it, remember, that's what's going to be left, how people remember you.
So, oh yeah, I've gone for all my best parts here. So I am definitely leaving behind for my beloved wife Tara my organisational skills. She fucking needs them, if I'm honest with you, and she knows that. I mean, honestly,
the opinions of Howard Cohen are not shared by all the parties on this podcast.
This isn't about gender.
I didn't say anything about gender.
This is about the specific basis of my wife and me. Listen, that hummus. You got to put the hummus back in the fridge. I can't live like this, you know what I mean? Like, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. Anyway, so she can have the organisational skills. And then I think for my son, who's a four-month-old guy, Rhea, called Dylan, and he can definitely, you know, if something happened, you know, soon, I wouldn't be able to pass two things on to him that I definitely would pass on to him, which is my sense of humour, which is the basis for my entire existence, and
nice.
appreciating other people's humour, and drive. Like, and some people like to claim that's inherent in the Jews, as no, we're just born genetically with it. It's not true. You pass it on. you motivate your children to do more. And I think, just to clarify,
you mean that it's not inherited, it's learned behaviour? Because you said
it's not genetic.
It's
nurture more than nature.
Exactly.
Right.
And so I would make sure. And then the last thing I would definitely give, and I would almost put this out, like I would put this in ashes, Dane, and spread it over as much of humanity as I can, which is a general sense of caring about other people and trying to read other people. I often think that's my one skill, is I can definitely read people's body language pretty well.
I like
and
that.
And it makes me want to care about them. And I've had disagreements with some people in the past. And, you know, if they're ever listening to this show, which would be weird, I still think you're fuckers in some way. but I do care about you, and actually would rather have found a way to create peace and, you know, understanding and leave with a sense of love about whatever disagreement you have with anyone. So to me, I will always care about human beings, and I would like to pass that on to as many people as I could.
Nice.
That'd be great. I like empathy.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I should do more of that. I wish we could. I wish scientists should learn how to freeze dry that and then maybe put it in aerosols and then put it into planes, and those could be the new chemtrails.
I'll give it to Bill Gates and he can microchip it into us.
Yeah, that'd be great. Just vaccinate humanitarianism into people.
I'll be honest with you, and this is a slightly tangential point. I actually feel, and I don't often talk about myself that personally on this show, I actually feel it's a bit of a curse, actually. Like, so for example, you know, like, I won't ever go any specific, but if someone wrongs me, I think there should, I would rather be someone who just goes, right, fuck that person, and fuck that person for good, I'm done. And I never have that. I always have a feeling of wanting to empathise with whatever they've gone through that's led to them taking this. And I actually think it's a bit of a curse, personally.
I mean, it's I guess there's two sides to read everything, Howard. So there's maybe a need for validation and for harmony with other species, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I don't think it's a curse. You've got to look at it as more reflection of that person rather than yourself. As long as you're not completely submissive to your belligerence, then...
I just always wish that I could just, you know, like...
Can't we all just get along, is what Rodney King said.
Yeah. Well, exactly, and just cut it out of my brain. I'd be quite happy to cut something out of my brain and move on.
We want more of you, Howard, than we want of them.
Yeah, exactly. And rather than cut out your brain, it means that you have a frame of reference on how to treat other human beings based on a previous trauma, which is the right way you're supposed to deal with it. You know, which again, as Rhea said, is an esoteric truth rather than something that needs to be taught by rabbinic texts, I should say.
Yeah.
I
who are we going to get to replace us on this podcast if we both died?
Me?
I'll do it.
I think... Yeah, Rhea would do it.
Rhea would be good. Rhea would be great.
Absolutely.
Rhea and Russell Hicks would be a good partnership.
I'd definitely like that. Yeah. That'd be a good one.
I have so many questions.
So, yeah. Exactly. That's all we need. I'll do mine very quickly, guys, because I have my will. So... I like, based on that idea, Howard, I definitely would, take all of my sense of love and humanity, and I would have that distributed globally. Organ donor, so whoever's needing those can have the vital organs. The heart, however, I want that to be a bit more of a bit more scrutiny in that screening process, because I want whoever gets my heart to be someone who definitely needs it biologically, but I want to find out what their mindset is. Because, I want to be giving people the equivalent of, like, a jet engine to power themselves. I would give all the material stuff, the money and stuff, goes to my sister, my nephew. I'd probably give him the comedy and stuff as well. He seems to already be getting there anyway, so this would be a little boost, I suppose. But you know what I would give? I would give my vitality to my mother, because she has a degenerative disease, and I would like for her to walk again, even just to say goodbye. But if I could, yeah, if I could give my legs to somebody, I'd give them to my mum. So,
oh, that's really sweet.
That's pretty much it. And then,
I feel really selfish now for only giving to my immediate family.
Yeah, but if you've raised them how you want to, then I'm sure they'll distribute that equally. Because I was saying, my mother, you know, she's not able to be that mobile, but when she was, she would basically figuratively break her back for her family. So that's why if I give her my spine, I'm sure she'll make good use of it.
And I think, just going back to what Ria just said there, I don't think there's a wrong answer to this question.
No, not at all.
And we would love for our listeners to tell us
metaphysical will and testament. We'd love for guys and the guys and the girls and those of you in the non-binary community as well to let us know what you think.
It's been an amazing episode. We have jumped between so many different things, Dane. I often wonder if we'll be able to always find new and interesting things to discuss on this show, but it amazes me every time.
Absolutely. I think as long as people have brains and frontal lobes, then we're always going to be able to question everything. So, yeah, there should always be a job. As long as
people... Well, Ria, you've been a wonderful addition to our alumni.
Oh, well, absolutely! Thanks so much for having me.
No, it's been a pleasure, and I hope that you've enjoyed your debut on the podcast. For those who don't know, Ria has also joined my label, so we are now label mates on UTC, so look out for more of her. But for Ria, for those people who have been so sad to not know you before today, where can people find you? What are you up to? Where can people find out more about your work?
If you just Google my name, Ria Lina, which is R-I-A-L-I-N-A, you're going to find me on your social media of your choice, except for TikTok. I'm a bit too old for TikTok. I can't figure that out. But I'm on the other ones.
No one knows how old Ria Lina really is. But we know too old for TikTok is the basis, so we're working with that.
Yeah, I am too old for TikTok. If you're on TikTok and you're a massive TikTok fan, you're grateful that I'm not on it. Let's just put it that way. clogging it up. I need more than 15 seconds is what I'm saying. But yeah, you can find me on there. And I also have a podcast called Ria Lina's Behind, which you can find again on all the podcast things, where I look at the news and then I talk to someone and go, explain to me the history of this news story, because I wasn't around when Belarus first got its dictator, so I don't understand what's going on now, for example. Or the basic science of COVID, so that you can help understand what you're doing.
Belarusian is the least spoken language in the whole world.
Really?
I think maybe Europe, but yeah.
Do you know what means White Russian? Because it's the one area that wasn't taken over by... this sounds so wrong in today's parlance, but it's true, by the Mongs when they were spreading through Russia. They didn't take over, so it's known as White Russia.
Wow. Belarusian. Nice fact. You get more of that on her podcast, I imagine, if you've done a Belarusian episode.
It's coming up.
Yeah, very good.
Cool,
well,
cool.
It's been a joy, Ria. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I think you have definitely reminded everybody that as long as there is science and religion, people will continue to question everything. So thank you very much for the jumpstart, Ria, and also welcome to the team, and I'm sure we'll be working together. So yeah, I'll see you at the Christmas party via Zoom.
Zoom Christmas party!
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeaste. Our guest was Ria Lina. You can follow Ria on social media at RiaLia_. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Decode. You can follow D on Twitter and Instagram at OfficialDecode. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.